Do you feel continually let down by modern media? Do you miss the good old days, back when all that mattered was a good story and not some agenda? Do you have ambitions of picking up a pen and pad and fighting the creative war yourself? Then this is the podcast for you. Each week, I'm going to talk to a creator who said enough is enough and started making the content they wished was out there. Join us as we discuss the ups and downs of the self-publishing world. We want to help empower you to join the Iron Age of media. Welcome to Iron Age Marketing. Welcome, everyone, to Iron Age Marketing. This is Nikki P. As always, I'm here with our guest today, Mr. Daniel McCarthy, the author of the book Story to Nowhere. How are you doing today, Daniel?
Story of Nowhere.
Well, Story of Nowhere.
Same thing. I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Full disclosure, Danny is a good friend of mine, and we host a podcast together called The Road to Hell Film Reviews Podcast, where we look at science fiction movies and kind of get into some of the more esoteric backgrounds of the ideas in them. But I met Danny because Danny is an expert of sorts on the concept of utopias. And as you can imagine, there is a ton of people really, really interested in utopias. It's, you know, everyone's walking around every day asking about utopias, which is why, you know, he has a book that's sold millions of copies and, you know, changed the world. Is that accurate?
Oh, yeah, man. I'm onto my third car now. We've got a couple houses out on the lake. It's great.
Or is it more accurate to say that it's a topic that most people probably never think about? It's super niche, and, you know, going out and finding your audience has been its own struggle.
Yeah, it's been rough. I have no marketing inclinations whatsoever, unless people are interested in just hearing me nerd out on them. If you can call that marketing, then I'm all right at it. But as far as going out and getting an audience and putting my stuff in front of people and convincing them that they really ought to spend their hard-earned money on it, I'm not really that guy. At least I haven't fostered that guy within myself. So, no, I've had basically no audience. And when I do try to explain the book to people, it's usually kind of a mixed reception, depending on who I'm talking to. Like, some people can see why it's interesting or relevant, and then other people will just kind of be nice and be like, oh, cool, anyway, let's talk about something else. And I don't really pursue, you know, if someone's not really interested in this kind of stuff, I'm not going to try and convince them they really are, even though I do kind of believe that utopianism lies at the bottom of so many of our problems. I don't know if you want to get into that, but
Without question, I would agree with that.
Yeah.
I watch stuff all the time, and I'm like, oh, God, Danny needs to watch this. This is so up his alley, and it has nothing to do with anything we normally talk about. It's just it's everywhere. So, no, we say you haven't really done anything as marketing. Like, this project of yours has also fostered a podcast that coincides with the book. And I think you've had some just absolutely brilliant episodes of that. And I think we can classify that under, you know, the way of marketing, but it's also marketing that requires marketing to build itself out.
Well, thank you for that. Thank you for that. Your brilliant comment. Yeah, it's that the podcast is another thing. It's hard to get people to listen to it. And maybe its biggest difficulty is me not talking about it very much or telling people to listen to it because I'm not a marketing guy. Also, I've been told by people who have listened to it that it's a little, I don't know what you would say, advanced, difficult, technical.
I tend to think of it as dry. It's more that, like, you just cover such academic topics.
Yeah.
That it, you know, if you're not someone who's academically minded, it's going to be a lot of information. And that's also, I mean, to your credit, you do pack your episodes with a lot of information.
Yeah, well, I try to make most of them into actual essays, basically. Like, stuff that if I were to transcribe and throw some footnotes in there, which I've already kind of got available, that could be like an actual work, like an essay that would be published or something. And that's just what I try to go for, because that satisfies my own sense of research integrity, you know? So that's just a me thing. And, you know, maybe there, I'm sure there's a niche out there. I know there is, of people who are into that level of analysis. It's just not most people. And that's fine. I'm, you know, most people don't want to listen to that stuff, and that's all right. But somebody does, and I just need to find them.
Well, obviously, we can see that we've seen in your studio, you got a lot of books there. You chose to write a book. Even your podcasts feel more book-like than most podcasts. So why don't you tell us a little bit about, like, frankly, just your relationship to books in your life? And, like, what does that look like through your life?
Well, I've always been just, I've loved feeling and looking at books. Like, it's been a tactile and sensory delight for me ever since I was a small child. So I don't know where that really comes from, but because my parents weren't very bookish individuals at all, but I just always was gravitated towards them. I enjoyed spending time in the library when I was a kid, mostly poking around in, like, the religion and philosophy and politics sections. I was a strange young boy. And then when I got older, I continued down this path, I suppose, of just pursuing my own interests, historical concerns and things of that nature. Again, philosophy and religion and such. And then I started going to these library sales. I don't know how, I think I might have just been at a library in a local town around here. And they happened to be having this book sale in the basement. So I moseyed on down. And, you know, it was 25, 50 cents per book. And they also had this deal where if you fill up a brown paper bag, it's like $2. And so I just, all right, my addictive personality and my impulsive personality, they all reared their heads at once. And I just started pulling everything off the shelves, loading up bags.
This sounds like somebody who hasn't done a lot of moving in their lives also.
Yeah, at that point, I hadn't even moved out of my mom's yet. I was still kind of young. So I think I spent like $100, maybe $150 at this. Again, everything was like a quarter, and I spent $100. So I came out of there with boxes. Like, my car was weighed down with just boxes of books. I've got, I mean, like, here's a complete Encyclopedia Britannica set I just got. Because why wouldn't you? It was like $15. I got the Harvard Classics. I got, I don't know if you can see them, but those like cream colored books there, that's an old set. I got that. All kinds of stuff. And after that, I realized how easy it was to accrue not just books. Because I'm not just picking up anything willy-nilly. I'm going in there and finding stuff that I think is relevant to what I'm interested in. So then I just started hitting up these library sales and getting more. And more and more and more. So by the time I moved out of my mom's, I had like, I think it was like 21 big boxes just packed with books. And so my relationship with them, impulsive, addictive, consumptive, probably unhealthy.
Well, and more importantly, I think is your interest in them definitely skews outside of like the pop mainstream, you know, book buying. Like, you tend to be interested in the esoteric, like the old, or we'll say more of like the formative intellectuals. You know, it's the stuff that you seem to spend the most interest on. You know, my wife has been in a classics, you know, group with you for a while now, reading Plato and Socrates and things of that nature. So, I mean, is it safe to say that like you kind of have like an academic personality?
Well, personality, I don't know. I mean, the line of this part of me versus that part of me is often difficult to find, or...
The yin-yang of Danny.
Yeah, I don't know, because on the one hand, yes, I've got a kind of scholarly bent about me, of course, but then on the other hand, I really hate academia and academics, and I'm not a hoity-toity kind of person. I work in a factory, and I guess
it's funny to think about like what an academic means to different people in that. Cause I mean, I think academic, I think Kerouac and.
Okay. Well, yeah. So, I mean, I'm interested in the big questions. I'm interested in metaphysics and what is truth and what is the nature of politics and power? Where, if anywhere, is history driving us? I mean, I'm just interested in the nature of these really big things, but part of me kind of resents the idea that academia and academics, these professional, institutional sorts of people, in the modern or, you know, progressive conception of scholarship or whatever, the academics kind of have a monopoly in a way on the big questions. You know, if you want to concern yourself with history, well, you've got to go to this particular institution and get a particular certificate and talk to particular people, et cetera, et cetera. Can I swear on this show? Fuck those people and fuck that whole mindset. That's insane. You mentioned Socrates. Well, if you read your Plato and you go back and you look at the life of Socrates, he was a schlubby guy. He had greasy hair. He wore robes and just kind of walked around barefoot through the city and would ask the professionals, what is justice? What is piety? But he wasn't a professional himself. The professionals killed him. You know, so I resent the idea that there's this kind of institutional monopoly on the big questions. The big questions belong to all of us. So am I somebody who, yes, I have an academic approach. I try to hold my work to a high standard where I source what I'm saying and back it up, et cetera, et cetera, and frame it in a way that's, I hope, rhetorically pleasing and understandable to people. But I'm just a regular dude who, like, can joke around, and I don't take myself very seriously, even though I maybe sometimes kind of talk like I do. I'm really just having fun. Like, I do this because it's fun, and I'm enjoying myself, and I enjoy talking to people and shooting the shit and all that. So I don't know if I'm academic or what my personality
is. Well, I mean, I think of you as academic, even though we both met through a group called the School Sucks Project.
Right.
I think academic is, frankly, aside from like the industry of academia, I guess. I think there's very few academic things going on in that environment, frankly. But the reason I bring it up is it's safe to say, like, you have an actual area of study, like utopias and this idea of like the perfect place or this nowhere, this unachievable ideal that you chase down and study the thought of how it exists throughout history. And, you know, your credentials are you're a guy who works in a factory. So the likelihood of Princeton Press going and putting out your book and your academic study on this topic was never going to happen.
Right.
You're not the person. You're not credentialed. Who the hell is this guy? And so you go outside like what would be the normal channels, and you have this idea. You might tell me, how old were you when you actually first released the book?
25, right? Yeah, I think I was 25. It was in 2020.
So 25, you have this mission to spread these ideas about this particular historical topic. And you go and you wrote a book and then you published a book. What did that look like for you? Like how difficult was that? Like, did you have a lot of different ways you thought about doing it, or did you just kind of always know how you were going to do it?
No, there were a number of manifestations where I had to just, you know, scrap it and start over again because it turned out the way I was approaching it wasn't going to work. So people can, it's a small book, very little, thin, tiny little guy. But it's
bigger than most people read these days. So
you're telling me, brother. It took me a year to write it, just that little thing. And that was part of the reason it took so long is because I was working. When I first started writing it, I was actually working two jobs. And then when I finished it, we were in the midst of all of the COVID lockdown stuff, and my factory job was shut down for a little while, so I had free time to finally just bang it out. But the actual process of writing was very difficult because you've got to hone your rhetoric and all of your ideas in the tightest possible fashion, and I didn't succeed. I mean, like, I look back at the book, and like, there's constantly stuff that I'm thinking, I could fix this, I could rewrite it this way, blah, 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 but you got to put it out. And maybe one day I'll do a revamped or expanded version or whatever. But it was very difficult writing it because, like I said, I needed to hone the arguments and make sure everything was as tight as possible. But then also because I took a self-publishing route, I had to do all of my own editing, all of my own formatting. I did the cover design. I had to get it all printed and bound and put together. I didn't personally do the printing or binding, but I had to find a service that would facilitate that stuff as well as the distribution. I've got a third party that takes care of that stuff, but I had to make sure it was going to be cost effective for me. And the service that I use like I said, does no editing or formatting unless you want to pay him like $3,000 or something crazy like that. So I just did it myself. And that's worse than writing the book. I mean, making sure, because I put my intention with this thing was to make a book that is both intriguing and useful to somebody who has already a basic understanding of certain historical elements that I discuss, and just kind of providing them with a new lens or a new way of looking at it, but then also to have the book be accessible to somebody who's not familiar with any of this stuff. I was really trying to find a middle path where the book could be accessible to anybody. I don't know if I succeeded, but I mean, some people say I have, and other, I don't know. No one's told me I haven't, but you know how people are. They're conflict averse. Not that I would be upset by that. I'd like to know if it's accessible, but whatever. I was trying to make it accessible, so there are pictures in the book. And I don't know if that was a good idea or not, but I put in some images of figures that I was talking about, and I had this terrible problem where I would format the thing and convert it to the PDF, blah, 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 get the text to wrap around the picture just right, and then I'd send it off to print, and it'd come back, and I'd hand the book to somebody to read it, and they'd be like, hey, chapter 6 doesn't make any sense. And I'd be like, okay, thanks. And I'd go back and read it virtually and be like, what are they talking about? And then I looked at the print copy, the draft I had given them, and the picture had just covered up a whole paragraph. That happened a number of times. That was particularly infuriating. So I managed somehow,
okay,
by like sheer force of will, to get over that hump. But yeah, formatting sucks. So if anyone's going down the self-publishing route, beware. You know, you should do it. If you're going to do it, do it. But look out.
Well, it's funny because talking to you, you must at least be some type of masochistic, because more than just putting out this book, you've also started converting some particular versions of older books into physical books. And you act through your website, you actually have a library of books that you've edited and formatted to be printed. because you feel like the information in these particular books is perhaps in danger of being lost in the digital age, with people who maybe don't want certain ideas leaked out there.
Yeah, that's the idea. It's still very nascent, this project, but I would like to actually develop a pretty comprehensive catalog of various sorts of works, be they the so-called great books or just more esoteric stuff that people might not be familiar with, that I think is historically significant and is something that's worth preserving in physical form. This is a conversation that you and I have had many times, but in my opinion, the digital world is kind of perpetually at risk, because you can look at things like archive.org, which is a great resource for finding old free material.
Well, will it be in the future?
Right. Will it be? That's a
great question. You know that they just lost a big lawsuit over about them hosting a library on the website that they had legitimate rights to copies, and during the pandemic were loaning out their rights so only so many people could have them at a time, and they were sued for that by, you know, the modern publishing industry. You know, when you talk about digital copies, Tim Pool had been distributing music on Bandcamp, and in the past he was just taken off of Bandcamp because political reasons, is as much as we can guess. They just didn't like him. The music itself wasn't even overtly political. It's just music. But he was kicked off Bandcamp, and all those people that thought they owned Tim Pool songs no longer have access to things that they purchased on that, you know, that website, based on the politics of the people running it. So, you know, I will always fight that the physical versions of things are important to have. You know, I've had record, you know, digital copies of albums where songs have disappeared because, for political reasons, you know, such and such an artist decided they could no longer stand behind their song, or the artist goes and changes their name. You know, they're no longer the Dixie Chicks, they're the Chicks, things like that. Like, there's so many reasons nowadays that people like to disappear things.
Yeah, and the digital playground is useful, and we can use it, and we can get a lot from it. And certainly we're using it right now to kind of expand our reach. And it's done wonders for getting people connected. But that doesn't mean it's a perfect playground. That doesn't mean that it's infinite in its usage. It's got limitations, and one of those limitations is it's very easy to restrict things. I know that we've kind of, in the past, there's been this idea that, you know, once something's out on the internet, it's just out there. That's not quite true. As we've seen, I've watched this happen with historical works that I consider very important. You could still buy it, but I've watched like PDF availability of certain books just vanish or get put behind a paywall. Documents, articles from news sources get deleted. One of the things I'd like to do with this library of mine is actually get news articles and government documents and start printing that kind of stuff too. That's just at risk, that I think needs to be preserved in a physical form. It's all well and good to download this stuff and keep it on your hard drive. You should do that, but you should also have a physical copy for when the power goes out.
What's even more important than just physical forms, actually, because, I mean, other things can happen, fires, and all that microfiche that you had the last 80 years of newspapers saved on for that one particular town in that library. I mean, that goes up, you're gone. You know, having it stored other places, you know, helps lessen the chance, you know. It's the one nice thing about a nice decentralized, you know, cloud kind of system is that things can be a lot of different places backing up an idea. Problem is that there's usually, in most cloud applications, there's some type of central authority that's kind of skimming, deciding what gets to be saved, what doesn't.
Exactly. So this project is intended to just kind of be a hedge against that sort of centralized deletion, or even just trouble with the power grid. You know, you can have every single book that's ever been written on your laptop, but, you know, if the power goes out permanently, well, you're screwed. So I also, like, speaking of the power going out, I want to have old books and stuff that detail like survival skills or like old farming techniques and all kinds of different things that would be useful in a variety of different situations. Because, you know, a tenant of mine, and I think of many people who are concerned with potential problems that may occur in the world, redundancy is one of those solutions that we can employ. And so everything that I print, I've also downloaded. I've got a physical copy, or a digital copy, rather, saved. So I've got it in two places now. I've got a physical copy and a virtual copy. I think that's one way to kind of hedge against this. Well, without going too deep, I suppose. I feel like the trend online now is moving towards this sort of like rent or lease service kind of thing. So if you go on archive.org and you want to look at a particular book, you can't download as many PDFs as you used to be able to. Now you've got to sign in and then rent for an hour. You know, so you can take a book digitally out of their library. And that goes to what you were saying with this lawsuit. Copywriters or whoever wanted to make sure that certain books, certain material wasn't just being pilfered off of this website. They wanted to restrict it. So now you have to rent stuff rather than you used to be able to just download it. So I like to do my best to keep things on this side of the paywall. Now, of course, you have to pay me to get the book. So, I mean, there is a paywall, I guess. But at least you're getting a physical copy. And I try to make an actual nice edition of the book. So, yeah, that's my project. And you're right to say it's masochistic. Maybe I was raised Catholic, so that might explain it. It's my own penance that I'm doing.
Well, it's interesting to me. So obviously I chose the Iron Age marketing title for this based on this concept of the Iron Age media that's going on right now. And not, I'm sure that you're not someone who's probably spent any time thinking about that term. If you've ever heard of that term, it was probably through me. But what you do and like your ideas are certainly in line with the ethos and the goals of the people that are in that movement. You know, the idea that there are people that have kind of cornered the market on publication or you know, creation of art or propagation of thought have all bought into a very narrow view of the world. And that if we want to have the ideas that we want to have put out there for other people, we have to go and do it ourselves and take care of the means of production, I guess, on that particular side of things. I hate the means of production, but it is a real thing. And the people that have taken monopoly of it for so long have been poor stewards, I guess I would say, or, you know, horrible dictators. One or the other, possibly both.
Yeah, it's a very agorist approach, like using whatever services we can while we have access to them, to at least this is what I'm doing, using these third-party printing services and stuff to just pull stuff off the internet while it's still available. And, you know, that this project of mine, one of the things that I want to do with it isn't just go through and pick out everything that I want to print and then print it. I want to take requests from people too. So I've got a special email set up, nowherelibrary@mail.com, that people can write to me and say, like, look, I think this particular book ought to be printed. Here's why, blah, blah, blah. And then we'll work out some sort of deal where, like, okay, you'll pay me to do the work, and then we'll get you a copy of this book that's, it's not from a publishing company or anything. It's from me. And then it can go up on the library, the website. But of course, the problem there is you got to be sending me requests that are out of copyright and blah, 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 because of all this legal crap. So that's still a hurdle where, it limits the stuff I'm going to print. But of course, the vast majority of books are out of copyright just by virtue of time. So that's cool. But still, like, you can't be like, oh, I want this New York Times bestseller that just came out. Can you print it for me? Like, no. I want to print stuff that's, again, it's kind of like there's an artifact or relic nature to the stuff that I want to print. But, well, there are other things that I can do with certain works that I think are very important that are maybe, well, we don't need to talk about that on a recording.
Right on. Well, is there anything else you'd like to leave, potential, authors or creators with, who are interested in making books of their own, particularly in the physical path? Are there, any tools that you think are invaluable to have?
Well, luckily, the internet has made it easy to find services that will print your book and then distribute it for you. The one I use is called Lulu, LULU.com. And they've got their own little marketplace that you can sell your stuff on. So that's a great resource. It's one that I've used. And aside from that, I think that if you want to go the physical route, which I hope you do, understand why. Because there is a level of difficulty to it. It's more difficult than having to just format an ebook, because you've got to take into consideration how much margin space you want, how you want the text to fit on the page, making sure the text isn't too tucked into the spine, all that stuff. Plus, you're going to have to consider cover art and spine and back, and then make sure it all fits properly. There's a lot of work there. So the number one thing I would say is know why you're doing it, why you want a physical book as opposed to just a digital book. Have a motive and understand it and understand why you think it's important. Yeah, like really just that sense of driving purpose would be the number one tool that I would recommend people hone.
I mean, if you think of your work as disposable and, pulp, perhaps, maybe it's not the route to go. If you don't care if it's here in 50 years, whatever. But if you want to stand the test of time, existing physically in the world is certainly going to make that an easier job.
Well, and also, there is a literal but also figurative weight to having a physical book. It's something that you can hand to people and then they touch and they say, wow, you wrote this? And you say, yeah, I did. Printed it too and made the cover and all that stuff. People say, whoa.
Something I can put up on my library.
Right. It's it impacts people. Even that's not to say that everyone who is impressed by the fact you've written a book is gonna read your book, but there is something that's kinda nice, I suppose, to actually handing somebody a copy of your book that you wrote and saying, I did this. It leaves an imprint on them in a way that I don't know that a digital product would. Just because it's more ethereal, the digital product. It's out there somewhere. It's in the computer. And it's, anyone can, make a digital product. Anyone can type up a Word document. But to actually have a relatively shiny, professional-looking copy of something, people are impressed by that. And that might help I'm sure the more marketing inclined individuals out there can make more use of that fact than I have, but nonetheless, it's there.
Right on. Well, you have any links we can send people to? Otherwise, it's been great having you on there, Danny.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. This has been fun. I like flapping my lip. The website for my podcast is storyofnowhere.com. All of my stuff is there. storyofnowhere.com/book is where people can buy a physical copy of the book. They can read an ebook of it if that's what you like to do. Pretty much every podcast app thing has my podcast in it, Story of Nowhere. I'm trying to keep it real easy for you folks out there. And the audiobook is in the podcast feed, so you can listen to that there too. I recorded the audiobook myself. And then finally, the Story of Nowhere Library project with my very limited catalog at this point of books, storyofnowhere.com/library. And you can pick up a copy of some old weird stuff there if you want to.
Right on. And I'll add that if you're interested in hearing me and Danny talk about science fiction movies and old books, check out roadtohellfilmreviews.com.
Yes, please do.
Do you fancy yourself the next Tolkien, Lewis, or Barker? Maybe you just have something subversive to say. Hopefully this podcast is helping you. But maybe your ambitions are just a little bigger than you can handle on your own. Head over to ironeedsmarketing.com and let Nikki P. help ensure your book doesn't release to nobody.